Like a news broadcaster, yeah.
I'm coming to you live from Portland's spiritual site of mad frenzy, Mount Tabor.
Yes, the beautiful hub of energy and spirituality of an ancient volcano. Trees that have been here for hundreds of years. I mean, what a gift in this concrete metropolis. So, Valerie, what do you find yourself thinking about most in this period of life? What are you looking for? What energy are you moving through? What's troubling to you? Anything along those lines? Like, what's the theme of this period of life?
Well, it actually kind of ties into the whole reason why I'm here, not just in Oregon, but at Tabor. I mean, one of the great kind of things that I feel most people grapple with for a long, long time is loneliness. And I mean, when I got to Oregon, I didn't know anything about this place except for the fact that I would be living right near Mount Tabor, and I knew that it was an extinct volcano, and that felt really important for me to know. That I mean, I was prepared to come here and feel isolated and alone, especially in a city context. I feel like it's much more difficult for me to set roots in something that's already so intertwined and so complex. I mean, it's an organism within itself. Like, how can I possibly set my feet down and feel at home? But knowing that I would be next to a landmark like this, just this marker of, I don't know, almost magnitudinous history that is beyond everything, that is beyond me, that already gave me this consolation of loneliness is a fallacy. It doesn't exist. That's been something that has guided a lot of my travels, actually.
Do you find it difficult to be alone, or do you enjoy it, or do you need like a mixture of social time and alone time?
I guess that's the thing is, I mean, of course it's been a challenge, you know. I mean, I think one of the first conversations we had was this sort of mutual understanding of, you know, you spent a lot of time feeling isolated, and that crafts you into a person that has to be okay with it. I've come to realize that it's an engine, you know, that loneliness is in itself a vessel for creation, especially when you're moving from place to place. You're completely anonymous because you get to establish the boundaries of when and where you exist with a capital E. Do you know what I mean? I've come to really love the fact that I can be lonely and that I can be comfortable in my loneliness, because then when I choose to really be and to really connect with people, then I do it from a place of total genuine intent, not because I'm desperate for contact, because I've resolved that, but because, you know, this is, the moment is imminent. You seize it, and then you are. And that I've found can only exist if you've understood what it really means to be by yourself, and to really be in positions where your loneliness is dangerous or life-threatening. You only have yourself. It's important to me to be alone.
There's a lot of like necessary self-confrontation that happens during those periods of time, and I mean, I don't want to overly generalize, but it seems like some people have a fear of being alone, of sitting with themselves, of sitting with their own thoughts, and of going to the darkness or the shadow within. And I mean, I've known people like this, or had friends who they just jump from one thing to another, and they're always doing something, they're always with people, they're never alone. And even asking them questions that verge into the vulnerable, like, they have a hard time answering. And that's not better or worse or good or bad, but just something I've observed. And I don't know, because I think like it is scary and daunting to be alone sometimes, and to have nothing else to do but to sit with your own thoughts and be like, fuck, my brain is pretty scary sometimes. And what am I going to do with this? I've noticed from a lot of your photos, like, you've done a lot of travel and often you are out in nature on your own. What does that do for you, or how do you experience nature and why do you seek that out?
I mean, I kind of always have. It feels as natural to me as breathing. It's the first thing I look for in a place is the autonomy that I can have in being able to step outside of maybe some social confines and connect with a place on a maybe deeper historical, geological, biological level. It's always my first introduction to anywhere. It's definitely being alone in nature specifically that has that power. Is you listen deeper, your mind is quieter, there's less to question about it. There's less of you and more of it, and therefore you can find yourself within all of it. I mean, these really big concepts of the collective unconsciousness and universal connection and the divine in everything that maybe I at one point in my life found a little flowery, a little bit too simple. But then you fucking realize it is that simple, actually. It's okay for things to not be escalated to this level of extreme complication and musing and identification. It's just brought me a lot of peace that I can go into a place that does not give a shit that I'm here.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Gosh, feeling that anonymity within a certain city or place. Is there a country or a city that you've visited or a place in nature that stands out as like a substantial point in time that taught you a lot, or that was like the catalyst for a big shift? Or maybe there's probably been more than one, but does anything stand out as prominent?
Yeah, definitely. It is for sure true that it's more than one place, but what really comes to mind is just being in Scotland over the winter, where I not only had, where the context of the whole thing was a little ridiculous. I was making my way up from Amsterdam to the north of Scotland over the course of a month. It's like 3 to 5 hours of daylight. It's raining or snowing most of the time. It's the second wave of COVID with that new variant that happened last winter. So everybody was in hiding again. And here's me fucking around on a top of a mountain in Inverness trying to find the remains of a Pictish fort, and I'm as happy as can be. I'm like, I remember I was up there trying to light a little campfire with this absolutely busted lighter, just everything is damp, and then before I know it, it's getting dark, and then it starts to snow for the first time in Scotland. I was out until probably 11 p.m. just watching these little kind of silver ghosts all over the countryside. It really feels like the place where the myths are true. But it was a really isolating period. I was in contact with people, but it felt difficult to try and be in contact with people, not just because I felt like I was distinctly on a pilgrimage. I mean, I was visiting ancient Celtic holy sites, and I was traveling mostly by foot and by bus and trying to, I don't know, cross over these ridiculous miles of countryside that's not, tamed yet. And yeah, it was lonely. And that's exactly what I loved about it so much. That's exactly why I needed to go in the wintertime, why I knew right off the bat that I needed to do it alone, and I needed to do it during like the most frigid and difficult period of the year. Yeah, it holds a really special place in my heart for that reason, because I know that I won't ever be able to experience it in the same way again, that it taught me that lesson, and now I'm different, and I'll never be that version of myself that I was.
Right.
I loved it.
Gosh. What is it? What's Pictish? What is that?
So the Picts were basically the history of most of Northern Europe is tribal. So, you know, you'll have historical periods of like the Gaels, and the Picts were one of them. You might recognize them by some of their stone inscriptions. They have these really beautiful kind of do you know that symbol of the labyrinth? It looks kind of like a placenta, is what it reminds me of. It just winds over and over again. Those emblems are all over the place. And the Picts had a really distinct tattooing style that I just love. But yeah, the Picts, like most of the Gallic and Celtic tribes of the time, were you know, warmongering. So yeah, they would build these forts, especially at the, I mean, Inverness even. Inver is reference to, I think it has Roman etymology because of the Roman conquest of the time period. Inver as in the mouth of, and Ness is river. So like Loch Ness is Lake River, because it's connected to a body of water that flows through it and beyond it. But so, sorry, they would build these forts up high, kind of watching the mouth of the ocean to watch for people coming in, and they would defend their territory pretty intensely, which the Romans had a fun time dealing with.
Right. Gosh.
Yeah.
That sounds fascinating. I would love to go to Scotland at some point. There's such a distinct feel about, I mean, my main point of reference is Ireland, but such a distinct feel about places that have not been metropolized and where the land is mostly wild. And there's plenty of those sort of places in the US, I suppose. But, I don't know. There's something so disorienting about living in cities, and something kind of stagnant and stale, and that I didn't recognize until I went places that were far more sparse. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Nature just feels so big and rich in a place like Ireland, that you can just be swallowed up in it. And the energy there, the feeling of it, the peacefulness is so different and like so calming. And you know, it occurs to me that like that's the way that humans lived for most of our entire history until the last couple hundred years when we started building big ridiculous shit.
Everything. Yeah. But I mean, I don't know, that I feel like is more maybe reflective of our collective psychology and less of the actual nature of urbanized life. I mean, I'm always thinking about this concept of quote unquote wilderness, because it doesn't really exist. I mean, we know that most old growth forests were tended to by indigenous tribes that walked the lands before us, and we know that they left markers signifying a place to find water. We know that they would tend the forest to ensure that, you know, it wouldn't burn disastrously during bouts of drought. We know that they used it to forage and hunt, and we are just as much a part of, you know, the wild as any other species. You know, despite the fact that we're in the, you know, I mean, I guess we're in the Anthropocene. People are still wondering if maybe it's, you know, kind of like a real term. You know, it's that distinction between the Holocene and Anthropocene that's
I've never heard that term. What is that?
So Anthropocene is the period of, you know, Earth's history that is distinguished by humans. So we are, if we are in the Anthropocene, then we are the species that influences and touches upon most factors of Earth's nature. The Holocene is kind of a wider expanse of time, and the Holocene is essentially like the most biologically forgiving. So it's been the most peaceful in terms of, you know, natural phenomena, in terms of agricultural possibility, in terms of a planet that is flourishing. I mean, but back to this point about urbanization, I think that's reflective of a psychology that we maybe just aren't able to grapple with yet. I mean, I'm always thinking about we can talk about the fucking hijacking of attention, but that's a whole other ball game because that's so new and we really don't know much about it yet, because I mean, if you think about it, we only have two generations kind of to look to see the consequences of this. But I mean, a city is a cellular modality just like a tribe would have been, you know, pre-industrial revolution. That's natural to us. We're able to look after each other. We're able to establish societal norms and hierarchies. We're able to connect with ease. But I think maybe it's part of a bigger malady than just the fact that we're building infrastructure and, you know, kind of colonizing most of the face of the planet. I just think it's a bigger question. I think I don't know if it's right to kind of knock on urbanization as the one big thing, because then it also is like a great branching point for things like ecofascism. Like, we're the plague of the world, and you know, when the comets start falling and everything is burning, then it's like the Earth will heal. That's fucking awful. It's like you can't just fix environmental solutions with like a unanimous genocide of everything and everyone. That's terrible.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. A useless and unhelpful argument. Because it's
dangerous.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Because then it's, I mean, I hear this so much in environmental and sustainable debate. It's like, okay, we know that we're going to be faced with worse and worse news in terms of climate change. And if we adopt this doctrine of ecofascism, then there will be groups of people that look at communities living close to water and say, okay, well, it's great that they're drowning because there's less population now to squander resources. That's completely anti-everything. That is vile. We're not a virus. We are, the universe is, I believe, creatively intelligent. And the fact that we're defining a landscape is true. And the fact that mass extinctions happen is also true. If we're an engine for that to happen faster, then that's what it is. But we're not like some cellular deformity. You know, we evolved for reasons that we don't understand because we're we're part of it all.
Yeah. So you're a bit younger than me, and I'm curious if it feels, well, what am I trying to say? It's like I grew up in a fairly sheltered environment in which I didn't realize how much trouble the planet was in until probably, you know, late teens, early 20s. And it felt like this horrendous rug pull of just being like, oh my God, this whole thing is kind of fucked. And like, I don't know if I will see old age because I don't know if there will be a planet to exist in. And I'm curious what it feels like to be growing up in this world and then this state that we find ourselves in, and how do you feel about the state of humanity, and is there any kind of hope to turn this around or keep surviving?
So this is actually something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, especially I was kind of I was a little bit more of a maybe political anarchist in my youth. I was you know, like 12, 13, running around protests and rallies and things like that, and then, you know, spent some time trying to be a part of maybe bigger, like, collective environmental movements, you know, going to, you know, coming around with, like, petition sheets and all of that. And then, you know, and believed really in direct action. And then I was like, fuck this, I need to fix the system from the inside out. And then I had this dream of being an environmental lawyer, and then realized that too was disheartening and bullshit. It's like getting into politics thinking you're going to fix something when really you're probably going to end up in the cogs of the machine anyway, like everybody else. I don't know if I'm necessarily hopeful that things will really turn around and change in my lifetime, but I'm kind of okay with that. It doesn't make me a cynicist. It doesn't, like, I don't feel at all like I'm pessimistic about the state of the world. I'm kind of just, it gives me a lot more room to focus on establishing community and really relishing the fact that we can tend to one another and tend to things one by one, step by step. Definitely there was some resentment, you know, like, fuck all of you, why did you have to mess things up? But every generation feels like it's the end of the world, you know? There is no scarier time than the present, historically, because we have no reference point for the future. And that can either eat you alive, or that can be a vessel of motivation for you to just move. And sometimes that's not even, I mean, to me, that's not even about dedicating my life to some cause anymore. It's more on this basis of a ripple effect. If I can live in a way that's conscious, and if I can connect with people who are living in a conscious way, then I'm preserving my own faith. And maybe also extending it beyond myself. The one pet peeve that I have, really, is advocates who are completely swallowed by that rage. I know that it's a very powerful engine and a really kind of strong pull, you know, to sacrifice yourself. But it's like, we don't need martyrs. We need people who are alive with good hearts, with good intentions, and we need to look after each other. I also can't stand when I'm in communities of people who are older than me talking about things like this, and they begin to apologize feverishly. Like, I, working at the Nature Lab at university, you know, one of my employers is, you know, in her 70s now. She just retired this year. And she would, whenever we touched on these subjects, she would apologize. And it's just, not only is this useless, not only is this making you feel better about yourself to no cause. I mean, I empathize and appreciate the intention behind that, but there's still time. I forgive you, but... There's still time. I mean, there's no use in laying down and being so dismally sorry. I'm sorry too. But that doesn't serve anyone any purpose. It's not valuable.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And any given individual in a lower or middle class state is not the one who perpetuated these issues. It's the people in power who knew about this stuff you know, decades ago, and they didn't do exactly anything about it, and they were driven by money, and they were just like, you know, fuck the poor people, essentially.
Yeah, and that apology, it assumes your responsibility in this equation, and then disables you, which is like, fuck, okay, well, that's, you know, now we've all bought into the ploy. Now we're all screwed because you've assumed the guilt that's not yours. Guilt and shame, the two most useless and progress-halting emotions, mm-hmm. Right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. There was a period of time, a couple of years, I would say, where there was just this kind of general humming anxiety and depression, really, in the back of my mind, of just reading and learning about all the terrible things that are happening on Earth at once, and the way that human beings take advantage of each other, and being so overwhelmed because I could do nothing about it, most of it. And I am grateful to now feel pretty resolved about all that, because it's like, yeah, I don't have the physical or financial resources to make substantial change, but what I can do is kind of what you were saying, like, who am I actually surrounded by? Who can I actually help? Yeah, what is my community, and what is my meaningful contribution? And like, coming to a little bit of acceptance of like, well, we're not dead yet. I'm still surrounded by people that I can help in small ways and in meaningful ways. And so I'm just going to, one, stop reading so much news, which is mostly, you know, tainted to begin with, and is so built on fear-mongering and advertising and just bullshit and exaggeration that is making people scared on purpose, because that's useful to the people in power.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
But yeah, just being like, I can't live like this in fear and in agony. And like, yeah, there's a recognition that maybe shit is going to get real hard someday for someone in my position, but not now. So like, kind of let's go and let's try to just enjoy this and do what we can.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. How does, I don't know, like, so as far as art, the most annoying thing to ever be asked as an artist is like, where's your ideas come from? But I would more think like, how do you view art in relation to everything else? And like, what is your, what drives you to create? Is it like an inner compulsion? Is it mostly, do you make art for yourself, or is there any desire for people to, I don't know, how do you think about art, and why do you make it?
Well, I mean, I guess, first of all, I don't think it's a annoying question. I mean, maybe it's difficult to answer because it's so intertwined with a lot of other prompts, but yeah, I mean, you just kind of trailed off with this last sentence. I mean, do you make art for yourself or for other people? I believe that's unanimous. I think that's, if you have a compulsion to create something and externalize it, then it's already outside of you. I believe really in collective responsibility, and I think that touches everything. Most of the work that I make is, you know, with a lot of kind of organic imagery, a lot of symbolism, and a lot of references to maybe mythos. And that too also ties into each other. I mean, I'm a product of all of the thousands of years of cultural human history, and therefore I am a launching pad for something else to exist again. So that's why I believe that that for yourself and for everything else are the same. What you do unto yourself, you do unto others, and vice versa. But really, I guess, if I do have an explicit motivation, then it's reverence. That's intertwined with a lot of my spiritual affiliation, is if you revere something, you will imbue love into the creation of its image, and then maybe that again will be a kind of a pushing forward force of someone else to experience that love through you. So when I'm painting plein air, or when I'm, I don't know, drawing animals, when I'm creating like larger paintings that maybe are a little bit more symbolic or mythological in intention, then I think what I'm doing is hoping that the real admiration and real adoration that I have for the world that I experience can inspire someone else to feel the same. I mean, if we're talking about sustainability and we're talking about environmental advocacy and trying to find some hope in the mass influx of not hope, then if you can really show your genuine care and genuine love for something, then you're more inspired and more motivated to defend it. I think that's why so much of my paintings are, so many of my paintings are revolving around biomes and nature. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever look back at earlier art and see, like, with kind of the lens of viewing your younger self, and what sort of symbols or ideas you were trying to portray, and how does that differ from the art you're making now?
It's exactly the same.
Okay, hell yeah. Right on.
Which is awesome. Yeah, I mean, when I was really young, like maybe 5 years old or so, I was just painting firebirds and women with wings and all sorts of mystical mountains. And I'm still making the same work, essentially. I mean, but that's the thing, is you spend your whole life kind of grappling with questions that are far larger than you. And maybe the root of it all is a very simple answer and a very simple solution, is that you're going to come back to these formative experiences and formative inspirations that you maybe touched when you were a child. Same shit. I'm still making the same shit.
Ah, I love
for
that.
Sure.
Yes, yes. Hell yeah. What do you feel like, if you can even answer this, like, is there an intuition within you or a sense of like what your true will is, or like your purpose on this earth, or your deepest desire to do?
Well, this is great, because this also is an answer to the very first question about that I answered with loneliness. Is I've always thank you. Wished for freedom, you know, like every birthday candle, every coin toss, every serendipitous like moment of ephemera. I'm like, okay, I want to be free. But and I guess that's the root of kind of everything, is for me at least, is finding ways to liberate myself and finding ways to be just really vulnerably open and free in that. But that's the awesome thing, is like most great deep desires and most meanings of life, it is a constantly changing and uprooted definition. There's a great song, I think it's called Freedom is a Verb. It's something that always has to be questioned. You know, life is to me a series of questions with no answer that you are always going to be either negating or validating. You're going to surround yourself with people who validate your definition of things like truth and love and freedom. And you're going to be drawn to people who negate that definition. And that's going to create this tectonic resistance between the two of you, because the fact that you even exist to each other is already a threat to the entire fabric of the other's reality. So whether it's political advocacy and activism, headbutting with people who disagree with my definition of freedom and my definition of moral ethics. And whether it's meeting people like you, who I resonate with on a level that defines my world and defines my perception of my safety in this world. It's always about freedom to me, which is why it answers the question about loneliness, because sometimes that's where that freedom lies, is you grapple with yourself, you grapple with the things that confine you and bound you, and sometimes you realize that the things that are confining you and binding you is you, and that's, you know, your head can be a scary place, like you said. But that's the best, because if you weren't uncomfortable, then it's not worth it. It's like the degree of, I always kind of like use this phrase, the degree of suffering you feel is inversely correlated to the degree of joy that you can feel. It's basic laws of physics. I'm going on a tangent, but
that's what this show is all about. Damn. I love that observation about kind of running into that resistance with other people. And I feel like this is something I still grapple with a lot to this day, of thinking, how do I characterize it? It's like, yeah, running into people who have a vastly different opinion or way of life and having this internal moment of thinking, oh, wait, maybe I'm not acceptable to society, mm-hmm. or maybe the way I'm living is wrong somehow and that I need to adjust or reorient myself in order to, I don't know, belong or be living correctly, if mm-hmm. that's even possible. And slowly coming around to this sense of trust of my own intuition and my own belief, I suppose, of just like, no, motherfucker, I don't have to adjust myself at all. And much of where other people are coming from has been programmed into them by society or by the way they were raised, and like that is their limitation, it's not mine,
right?
But I still really struggle with that often, and yet, you know, in my heart of hearts, what I believe is that there's no rules, and that, I mean, I don't want to cause suffering to any other person, but otherwise pretty much anything goes, and like who I am and how I feel and how what occurs to me as a way to operate in this world is perfectly fine, because we're all already divine. And like the things that I am drawn to is that little spark of divinity in me moving towards what I'm here to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's definitely like this big grappling question of where do you belong and where do you feel accepted? That's a totally inherent, natural part of our biology, and it makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, it's our desire to be loved and to feel safe is a totally, that's intrinsic, and we wouldn't really be anything if it weren't for our connections with other people. But yeah, maybe this reconciliation with the other and why you are not like the other is one of the most valuable experiences to me. I mean, even if even if it's kind of like on a small scale, like you feel ostracized from your peers or you feel abandoned by your family. I mean, these things are so earth-shaking. Not just because of the betrayal of isolation and the betrayal of this greater scheme of the world, of why you feel like you have maybe this divine curse placed on you, that you're being, you know, shot down by the gods and whatnot.
Yes.
But that too, that breeds some of the most valuable first experiences of life. And then when it's on a larger scale, like facing things like real solid identity labels or affiliations or I guess, empathies. I mean, I remember this one time I was, when I was a little bit more of a rabid 14-year-old, I went to this one protest. I don't even remember what the protest was about. I don't even remember what it was for, but I remember that I nearly got into a fist fight with a kid about my age. Maybe he was a little bit older, over whatever it was we were both marching about, you know, or what he was not marching about. Yeah, he said something really crass to me, and I put my hands up, and somebody else carrying a sign who was maybe orchestrating the event a little bit, you know, sort of pulled us apart and looked at me in this really disappointed way. yeah, I felt like I was being admonished by like a school official or something like that. And then it just took that second for me to look and realize, okay, this like 16-year-old kid is me. We are at odds, and we are opposing one another for the same reason. He is me just as much as I am him, you know, if we're on two ends of an opposite spectrum. And that's how I've come to terms with a lot of feelings of alienation, is you realize that everybody is a product of their own individual upbringing, their own intricate and deeply convoluted histories. And when you kind of look at it from this perspective of maybe just pure acceptance for your own sake, not for anyone else's, for your own, so that life can be a little bit easier despite it all, then even things like trying to fit in become very simple. It is, you know, I'm attempting to join this pack of dogs because I feel very lonely and I feel like there's something very wrong with me. But underlying all of that, I understand that they are a mirror. I understand that they're trying to find their place just as much as I am. And whatever resentment they hold towards me is probably the same reason that I resent them. I've applied this to most things. I've applied this to injustices in my own family, on very personal levels in my own life. And frankly, it's made things a lot easier. Yeah, but that's the one thing, is you need to like, this radical acceptance thing is very easy to talk about and is very, it's easier said than done and all of that, because it's like, you know, the fewer words there is to a theory, the less believable it might be. but it has to be for you. It has to be coming from a place of bringing peace to you.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my spiritual teachers has this analogy of like, if life is a video game, you know, video games would be boring if there weren't bad guys to fight or if there weren't any challenges to overcome.
Uh-huh.
Like, a video game would be fucking boring if it was just easy and you walk around and you get everything you need.
Yeah.
And there's like this weird karmic lesson for everyone from the universe of just running into these people constantly throughout life who push against your wounds or push against your insecurities, and that just fuck with you in a way that's like, God damn it, another one of these. Like, I wish I didn't have to deal with this shit. But it's always, yes, both a mirror and like the very particular thing that you need to resolve within yourself and to learn to let go of is what it has felt like in my experience. And like, I'm very far from letting go of all that stuff and still run into those things all the time. And I feel like this is sort of a separate thought, but the artists that I've always admired, whether they are authors or painters or movie directors, are these individuals who are so uncompromising and they are their fullest self and they don't give a fuck what people think, and they're often considered by polite society to be kind of radical or scoundrels or flat out rude. But I love that energy, and I feel like that is in some ways the purest form of like the divine expressing itself through that individual body, through that person and that consciousness. And I feel like I want to get there, although there's never an arrival point in this life. I long for that so much, because I still care way too much what people think of me, and I'm still way too nice and polite a lot of the time instead of just like being my fullest self, which is not always so nice.
Well, I mean, yeah, like you said, there is no arrival point in life, which is the point. It's, I mean, like I said, it always has to be negated and validated. You have to always pretty much, I don't believe in the, maybe I am a little bit of a cynic then. I don't buy into ideologies because I don't believe that there is an ultimate anything. I don't believe in this ultimate free love. I don't believe that you can put up two fingers and call it a day. I don't believe that you can reach nirvana or this perfect enlightenment and then be a completely innocent and pure figure in the vast universe. I think that's bullshit. And I think anyone who tells you otherwise is forgetting the fact that we actually are not sublime beings. We have a really powerful and intuitive animal instinct. I love science. I also love spirituality, and I love studying religion. But I don't believe in ultimatums. And this thing of, you know, once you get there, you'll know. Okay. Thanks. But it doesn't, I don't buy it. I think it always has to be a learning process. If you decide one day that you are now fully developed and fully formed, and you are now the wise old sage, the embodiment of the hermit on top of the mountain, and now you can subtract yourself from the equation of everything, then you've actually gone way backwards. You're back where you started. It's if anything squanders learning process, including progress, then I believe it to be a negative result. You know, you can, I mean, it's great to give yourself credit for arriving to a point where you feel better than you once did. But there's always more. There's always more, and everything is cyclical. I mean, we were talking about the major arcana of the tarot. You begin as the fool, you end as the world. Does it end there? Fuck no. It's the whole point is that the world contains the fool and all of his naivete and all of his trust. And the fool contains the world and all of its wisdom and all of its intellect. And you start over again, over and over and over. And that's maybe one of the most difficult things to grapple with, is that it never ends. That can be either something deeply inspiring and hopeful, or it can be terrifying, just like how being in your own head and in your own personhood can either be a great feeling of safety, or it can be fucking terrible and you'll hate it. But that's the point, is you have to hate it first, and then you have to love it, and then you have to hate it, and then you love it.
Yes. The Ouroboros. Mm-hmm. Generating itself and eating itself over and over for eternity.
Yeah, my favorite painting of yours.
Thank you. Oh, hell yeah.
Completely.
Yeah. It's a fascinating symbol that I don't understand at all, and yet it continues to be interesting to me.
Yeah.
Do you feel free now in this period of life?
Right now? Yeah. I feel free right now. I'm sure I won't, maybe tomorrow.
Right.
Maybe in like half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I'm waiting for the next hill to climb, you know? But I know I'm ready for it, because if right now I am comfortable with my definition of freedom, then I'm able to use that lexicon and to use that raw experience to inform my next decisions. But no, I mean, I do feel freer than probably I ever have, but you know, it's like a, you know, you climb up the ladder, right, over and over. It's funny, it's the starving artist thing. I, for a long time, really resented the idea of having money, probably because I grew up not having much of it, and denying myself all sorts of things. Yeah, having some degree of financial independence has been a real gift to me now, because I'm still living like I'm broke, but I'm not so broke that I am suffering, which is something I'm deeply grateful for. And it is a big part of the reason why I feel free, is I can feel safe. I don't have to put myself into situations where I'm at serious risk. I don't have to put myself in situations where I'm dependent on people I don't agree with or people who take advantage of me. And I am free to go. Everything is my choice. Yeah, I do feel free. Do you feel free?
At this moment, yes. But similarly, you know, that could change by this evening. And it's just, yeah, these constant waves of falling back into, in my case, usually fear and usually some sort of assumption that I should be living differently or that I'm being foolish or that I'm getting something wrong. And that the gods are cursing me, or like absurd ideas, but that that I know logically are false, but they still creep up. And I feel better than ever, than any previous point of life, at being able to recognize and move through those moments, and even kind of sometimes just sit and close my eyes and breathe and like let it roll over me. But also trying to be curious about it, I suppose, and just be like, all right, what am I actually scared of? Mm-hmm. What is the worst outcome I'm imagining? And is that going to happen? And if that happens, can I handle it? And usually the answer is like, yes. And that most of those fears and worries are just fabrications anyway. Mm-hmm. I just feel like there's a lot of emotional baggage from my upbringing that I'm still letting go of. So it feels very chaotic and messy in lived experience, but also I'm so glad to be here and now, as opposed to where I was 2 years ago or 5 years ago and so forth. And like, this is kind of a trendy word used by Instagram influencers and all that bullshit, but just like letting go and surrender does seem to be the theme of this period of life, of just realizing this is all pretend in a certain sense, and we're just playing these games because we think we have to. Uh-huh. And is when I can trust myself and realize, Josh, you don't have to play the game. It's like, oh yeah, okay, cool.
Thanks for the reminder. Yeah.
right. The very first time we spoke and I was asking about all your travels and like the way you've gone to many different places, often by yourself and just in these totally new cultures and countries, totally alone, and you saying that it required a lot of, or that you had learned a lot of self-trust, essentially. I'm paraphrasing what you said, but, yeah, I mean, do you ever fall back into old patterns of fear or have moments where, and like, how do you bring yourself out of those? What are the mantras you tell yourself? What's helpful and how do you overcome that?
Yeah, fuck yeah, I do. But that's the thing, is your old wound. I mean, you know, I was gonna ask you what that fear is. And if it's your past and your upbringing, it's that wound that follows you. I mean, everyone has this great this great question to grapple with. But that's like our first toolkit. I definitely do fall back into my patterns. I mean, you know, in the past I've had a rocky relationship with my mental health and the way that I take care of myself. I've had some difficulties with things like substance use, and it definitely chases me around because it's my own personal typhoon, you know, like with everyone else. But that's the thing, every time I look it in the face, really stare this thing in the eyes, then I gain a little bit more of that trust in myself. It's sometimes challenging traveling and being completely anonymous and being a stranger, because I am also a stranger to myself. Every time I am in a new place, a new context, a new situation, I am reborn again as someone who owes nobody anything. I am reborn as someone who did not exist prior to my brief interaction with whoever I might be speaking to or the place that I might be standing in. And that for me can be a little bit dangerous, because then it's a free-for-all. And I can totally break faith in myself, and I can totally do things that I swore to myself I wouldn't anymore. It's always you face yourself over and over again. I definitely have come a long way with falling back into my patterns, because at some point, frankly, I got bored. Like, this is getting old. I learn nothing from this now, and I recognize it as a failsafe. But the way I come out of it usually, honestly, might be a little bit forceful. I mean, I was just traveling in Ireland with my friend Riley. It was her first time out of the kind of North American continent. And her mantra was intentional discomfort. And it's something that I fucking love, because intentional discomfort can mean either putting yourself into scenarios that are bad for you objectively, but it can also mean breaking the confines of your own predisposed self-destruction. It's uncomfortable to force yourself out of the house if you're in a bout of depression. It is uncomfortable for you to try and get sober if you've been on a bender. It is uncomfortable for you to stop talking to someone who you've known for years, even if they make you feel like shit. I try and carry that around. She has some great mantras. Another one is really awesome, actually. It's a little bit crass too. It's laugh it off and jerk one out. I spent so many years being just total stoic, and you know, like, everything has to be for real, like everything has to be legit, and then Riley just comes up out of the blue, like, with this perspective of laughing at it all. And sometimes that's what it is. I've ended up in situations that are really awful, like stranded somewhere or with a stranger with ill intent, and frankly you know, beyond using my best judgment, it's like, okay, let's laugh at this for a second, and maybe I'll come back to my head, you know, maybe it'll return me to my bearings. That's been a big thing for me, because I've taken a lot of things very seriously, and that's not always beneficial. Yeah. It might not be a good answer. It might not be advice that anyone should take. But it's what works. It's what works for me.
Yes.
Frankly.
No, that's a marvelous answer. It sounds like Riley has some unique wisdom of her own.
Yeah, she does.
Gosh, yes.
Oh boy.
That is also a lesson that continues to be presented to me is being able to have a sense of humor, because I also was so serious for so many years and still am a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And there's like this very inquisitive, what is it? There's like this little intellectual in me that's like thinks I have to take the world so seriously and ask all these important questions and try, like, from a very young age, I've just been trying to figure this shit out. Like, what are we doing here? What is this life? Mm-hmm. And really wanting to know. I suppose the lack of humor has come from that fear that I mentioned earlier. And just thinking, well, I can't laugh because everything, the world is always unsafe and I always need to be ready. But yet...
Defense mode will kill it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And thankfully, I've had friends throughout the years who were the total opposite of that, who are these carefree souls who, like, live by the seat of their pants, laugh about everything, and they're almost, like, never worried or concerned. And that is such a helpful energy for me to be around. And, yeah, and so I feel like I'm constantly trying to remember to just, like, fucking relax, Josh. It's all right. Like, things might be kind of bad in a certain sense, but it's okay. This is all a cosmic joke, kind of. Uh-huh. And just chill out. Like, and humor is such a useful device to be able to speak about the darkest parts of humanity and about existence. And to be like, yeah, this is fucked up, but it's also a little bit funny, because it's so terrible. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, no, it's, that's definitely something that I've found to be a lot more valuable. Yeah, I think this is definitely for, you know, something that we have in common. As, you know, if as a kid you spent a lot of time in a really guarded mentality, you'll find it super difficult to let go. I mean, survival mode does not lend itself to a whole lot of fucking knock-knock jokes. It's, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
If you're focused on being safe, then you're immediately in tunnel vision state. You can't see beyond your periphery.
Right. Yes, totally.
How have you actually come to terms with, have you reached this place of accepting the cosmic joke? Are you okay with being the punchline?
There are times that I am. I feel like I'm still pushing against it pretty hard in this time of life. Gosh, no, I run up against that all the time. And yet the universe keeps presenting me with situations where I have no other choice than to, yeah, let go and kind of laugh about it. And it's almost like I've felt that I can't be silly or carefree until I know that all the pieces are in place and that everything is safe and grounded, and then it's okay to relax. But realizing, like, over and over that it's never at that place. That is not how life works. No matter how many luxuries exist or, like, external comforts, and that there is always something, some kind of resistance pushing against a person. And so, yeah, that's still something I'm learning all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a huge challenge for me too. Yeah, I started off with absurdism. I mean, this, like, almost Dadaist view of the world. It's like, you know, these guys in the face of post-war destruction and all of this shit, we're just okay. So all of this actually is ridiculous. And maybe that's almost an altered consciousness kind of state where you're faced with great shock and a complete dissolution of your reality as you know it, and then you're able to tap into the absurd that nothing is making sense as it should. But that in itself is also a great gift, that the fabric of your reality is actually so thin. I mean, I'm always in my kind of like serious perspective of all things, I always refer back to biology. I always refer back to scientific principles. And then I remember that I am hallucinating everything, that my brain is the one organ that is enabling me to experience the fact that I'm sitting here on this beautiful rug with this great new friend. I'm able to experience the temperature, the things that I see, and it's something that I'm hallucinating based on a statistical proof that my brain is over and over again regurgitating and processing. It's fucking crazy, first of all. Actually, on Monday, I came over the hill and saw my friend Joe, who goes under Rocky Seahorse, is his title as a musician. And he sings this great song, I think it's called Sugarcoat. One of the lines goes somehow like, I'm going to paraphrase, he's talking about his sugarcoat as trying to appeal to the world surrounding him, and there's ants coming to take it apart, and they're carrying these sugar particles back to their anthill, and they are the harbingers of truth. Like, yep. It's all very frail. And absurdity is maybe something that can be a great comfort to grapple with. That this is so delicate. All of this is so fragile. You have to take such careful care of all of it, of yourself, of the people that you love. Every step that you take, every decision that you make has to be carefully examined before you commit to it. And in that is that great, great joke, is that we are such a small part of something so big, and maybe to laugh at it for a second takes away this really poignant and distressing fear that it's all up to you.
Yeah, goodness sakes. What a pressure for anyone to have to hold, to think that that would be true, that it all falls on an individual. I really like, I take a lot of comfort from comedians, a few in particular, in a similar way, as I mentioned, like artists inspire me. And I do feel comedy is an art, mm-hmm. in its own sense, because I've always, like, in my brain, I feel like I'm more honest about the bleakness of humanity than most of the people I'm surrounded by, uh-huh. and that polite society lives in this very surfacey level of like, let's make sure we never talk about anything dangerous or scandalous or like uncomfortable, and feeling like that is such a crime. And that it's like, god damn, we all experience such similar things, and yet we've been taught to not talk about it. And I feel like comedy is a way of being able to say the most fucked up stuff.
Yes.
That is absolutely true in a setting where it's okay. Uh-huh. And so, and even in some ways, like podcasts that I've done through the years, I mean, I'm not a comedian and I've never been on stage in that context, but it's just like, for some reason, I feel more safe saying fucked up things here than I do around, like, the parents at my daughter's school, because that would be radical to them and unacceptable, and I'm learning to lean more into that. But I don't know where I was going with that, but it's just comforting to me, too.
Well, personally, I think you're very funny.
Thank you.
To your credit. And secondly, about comedians, one of my favorites is George Carlin. Dude, I watched that guy way too young.
That's probably to your benefit in some ways.
Yeah. It totally was. It was one of the things that my dad and I bonded over, besides music, I mean, we would be listening to Alice in Chains and Lily Allen, you know, just completely ridiculous things for an 8-year-old to discover. Yeah, and we would watch George Carlin. And I remember having no fucking idea what the guy was talking about. I mean, he is completely bashing everything. He is so great at that. He gets on stage like a fucking philosopher. I mean, this is modern Plato, the way that he talks. And yeah, with this completely, I mean, you know those facial expressions that he does. He's just like wide-eyed and he stands there like this, questioning and quarreling with everything. And I continued to rewatch the bits that I watched when I was, you know, like 8 or 9. Yeah, his comedy is really rooted in asking people questions that they never would have faced otherwise. I mean, you can get on stage and you can talk about fucking bitches. You can talk about your balls for like half an hour. and then George Carlin gets on and he's asking mostly American audiences questions about consumerism and materialism. He's asking questions about our xenophobic tendencies. He's asking why we're so attached to things like financial gain and so attached to things like achievement. Even if it's, there's this great bit that I really love about, he begins it like a total dick. He's like, here are people who deserve to be murdered in this terrible way. It is parents who have bumper stickers of their kids' scholastic achievements. I'm like, you're a jerk. But then he goes on, like, okay, so you're probably unfulfilled. You're probably finding a way to feel like your life is worth something because you've produced this child who's able to meet your greatest expectations or not. He's like, we should have bumper stickers that are like, my teenage girl is knocked up at 16 and I resent her for it. I'm like, yeah. Oh boy, this is so true. These are, yeah, I mean, great things that we're always avoiding that maybe comedy can get us to face.
Right. Yes, it's causing people to be confronted with, like, why do we do things the way we do? And it's pretty much just because we've been taught that this is the way to do it, right, supposedly, by, like, previous generations and stuff. That's a very literary sentence.
I think it's exactly what it should be.
But yes, I love that. It's because any given joke is funny because on some level it's true, even if some part of us is like, oh boy, that's fucked up, I shouldn't laugh at that. But it's like, it's so true, and I recognize that experience. And so it's like, oh, thank God there's a context in which I can have some levity around this.
Yeah, and I mean, if you can laugh at it, you can internalize it. I mean, it's like philosophy. I had a really difficult time reading Alan Watts. I know that so many people love him, but I just listen to his extremely English recordings, the way he's talking about,
right,
peace and love. And I find it so much more separated from me than maybe comics or even, I don't know, passing drunken conversations. It's so far removed from me because it's almost a different dialect. You know, even if we're talking about things like code switching, you know, the ways that we communicate in terms of our vocabulary, how accessible it is to one another, that's a really relevant thing too. You know, there's which also connects back to environmental advocacy. If your doctrine and your belief is not able to be understood by a mass group of people, then it's maybe not helpful. Maybe that's another really vital part of comedy, is you can attract a crowd that is reveling in the sheer fact of something they can all understand, something that resonates with everybody on a personal level, something that can be related to mundane experiences and activities, and that's something that is a big divider for most people. I mean, this is like, there's a big uptick in hatred of like classical academia and classics in terms of literature. I mean, classical literature is not even a real genre. It's just books that are widely regarded as great for reasons that are differing. We can also, but we can regard plenty of authors as classics now. I mean, the definition has changed. Of course, there's a problem with that, but it's also because of this degree of separation, explicitly in terms of the access to education you have, the financial opportunities you have to be able to indulge in things like fucking Tolstoy or Dostoevsky and all of these. I mean, I love Russian authors, but fucking they're writing so much about aristocracy, it hurts. Yeah, I mean, that's the great merit of casual conversation as well. It's, you don't take it so seriously as maybe if you're in a lecture hall. And then it ends up being more valuable than plenty of other things.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It's like that's the truth of human experiences, of human experience in general. And like, yeah, how many nuggets of wisdom have I gleaned from, like you said, a drunken late night conversation where people's inhibitions are lowered and then they start speaking the actual truth that is within them that they're not scared to say anymore.
Yeah.
And somehow that is more powerful than maybe anything.
Yeah. There's a great line from Huxley's Doors of Perception. Again, I'm going to paraphrase it. He goes, to Christianity's great discredit, wine is not fit for religious ceremony. but not to wine's discredit. So it's, we gain these really illustrious and evocative experiences from being out of our minds and from being inebriated that maybe we just can't gain from sermons and hymns, right? Yeah, it's one of my favorite titles because he is laughing at himself the whole time. He's talking about this experience with peyote, and he's just like, okay, I'm going to reckon with the four legs of this chair. that's it, you know? He's talking about how he's not really tapping into the divine as maybe he should be, or he's not seeing these great cities rise up out of the colors that he's seeing in this mescaline chaos. But he's there. He's in it, and he's beyond himself, and he can laugh at it.
Mm.
It's so great. I mean, I think a lot about the experiences of maybe worshippers who would come to cathedrals in maybe the 13th century or so, and see these first representations of the holy through stained glass, and how that was just so much more applicable and so much more relatable, simply, than hearing Latin prayers for hours on end.
Yes.
You have to be there and you have to experience it in your body, in yourself. Yeah, it needs to be embodied completely.
Speaking of inebriation, I may be reaching a point of which I won't be able to ask good questions anymore. So, any final thoughts? And if you would like to point people to your art, where can they find it?
Well, I've got a severely neglected Instagram account and website. Mira Portal is the Instagram name, and
MIRRA Portal.
Yes, MIRRA Portal. Mm-hmm. And my website is ValerieAuroraMira.com, which is an extremely somewhat ridiculous name with great intentions.
Is that your middle name, Aurora?
Aurora. Or is that just... Yeah.
Wow, that's marvelous. What a magical name you have.
Thank you. It was a chosen name.
Okay. Yes.
Because Valeria Nikolaevna Vlasenka doesn't have the same ring.
Yeah. Americans would have no chance.
Oh, man. Cold War round two. Oh, boy.
Uh-huh. Right.
Yeah. No, but that's just it. And in that, freedom is a name. Freedom is a verb.
Yes. Marvelous. Thank you. This was wonderful.
Indeed. It was. Yeah. Thank you.
Cheers, Aldous Huxley.